This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If we're really talking impacts of climate change on Syria all the way to Flynn helping Turkey in the United States, it's a pretty big butterfly effect. But we need to understand that when it comes to geopolitics, when it comes to international relations, relatively small changes can have massive, massive impacts that are really hard to see.
It's been a bit difficult to keep up with the news since January. Every few hours, it seems like there's a new revelation in the global political wreckage that is the Trump administration. Whether you're more interested in how ties to Putin will lead to impeachment, how Donald Trump is systematically alienating the U.S.'s closest allies, or the possibility of the U.S. pulling out of the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, it's hard to deny that the international political scene is roiling. And with every international political churn, there are environmental causes and implications. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with energy consultant Alex Gilbert, who provides a clear recap of the past 10 years in international relations. He connects the dots and shows how political alliances among nations, policies like fracking, and environmental conditions like drought have helped to create turmoil in countries like Syria, Turkey, Russia, and even the good old US of A. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Alex Gilbert. He's the co-founder of Spark Library, which is an energy and consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Alex, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Happy to join you.
So we met via Twitter, and in particular, a bunch of tweets or a tweet storm that you linked together via Storify. You did a great job of showing the connections regarding oil, food, and the political mayhem both in the U.S. and overseas. Why don't you first outline your basic thesis for us?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the big things to kind of really remember what's happening with the political scandals in D.C. right now is that they are being impacted by foreign influences. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do here is I want to explore all of the threads and all of the things that have been happening internationally over the last 10 or 15 years that kind of led to the situation where other countries might get involved in our political situation. So I guess the kind of way to really start off is that people need to recognize that the last 5 or 6 years especially have been very chaotic with energy geopolitics. OPEC, which had really changed things and dominated energy planning for the last 40 years, may or may not be dead yet, but its power is definitely very much changed because of the shale revolution in the United States. And so that has had very significant impacts, and a lot of it is really timing. Because of the rise of China, because a lot of conventional oil resources were being depleted globally, prices rose in 2007, and they remained really, really high for years. Between 2007 and 2014, they were at or above $100 a barrel most of the time. Oil is so important to our economy, it impacts everything, that has pretty significant impacts on a lot of things. But one of the things that it really mattered for is oil exporters. Now, people talk about the resource curse as a development issue, but what we're really talking about here are petrostates, countries that rely on oil exports for funding. And one of the big things is that countries that were traditionally exporting oil, OPEC and then Russia, really started to rely upon $100 barrel oil to fund the government and to provide services to their people. And so the last couple of years, because U.S. shale oil has caused a global oversupply of oil, it's pushed back against those old countervailing trends, the price of oil has collapsed. In a matter of about 6 to 8 months, it went from more than $100 a barrel to almost $40 a barrel. And because oil costs money, you have marginal cost of production. That means that even though it went down about 60%, you actually decimated profits. Profits in many cases are almost non-existent for a lot of these companies. And that had pretty significant economic ramifications for a lot of countries. And so the big one that I really point out in exploring the tweet storm that I did is Russia. And so Russia, because of some really unfortunate timing on their part, because of renewed aggression in Ukraine and some other issues there, got hit with U.S. sanctions right before this big oil price collapse. So since then, we've actually been able to see that the value of the ruble has gone down by more than 50%. That has significantly impacted their GDP, and it's really hurt their ability to buy foreign exports. And so that economic warfare, which was not really intentional, combined with a lot of intentional sanctions over Ukraine and renewed tensions because of Russia's actions in Syria, to really lead to the point where the U.S. and Russia kind of are beginning to get back to a Cold War stance in terms of adversarial relationships.
So these oil prices obviously had great effects on petro states like Russia, but it also affected some of the world's most needy, vulnerable populations because oil is a primary feedstock for fertilizer, and so it affects food prices. Explain the connection there, if you will, and then how we got to where we are today.
Energy is very important for agriculture. So we use natural gas and a bunch of other things when we're creating ammonia fertilizer. Oil is used for in all parts of the agricultural process, from transporting food to running industrial equipment. And so one of the things that we actually do observe is that energy prices, and this includes oil, but includes all other energy prices, are really closely linked to food prices. And so when these oil prices started going up and energy prices started generally going up in 2007, 2008, on the back of Chinese growth, but really the factors I mentioned earlier, we actually started seeing something else happen. And that was that food prices globally started increasing. And again, food is tied to energy prices, has other things that do determine the price of food as well. It has its own supply and demand issues. One minor thing in the U.S. is that because the U.S. was starting to use corn ethanol, we actually had corn ethanol go from a few percentage points of our corn production to as much as 40%. That started impacting food prices too. So what we actually saw is that before the Great Recession hit, food prices had doubled within a matter of a couple of years, and they were at the highest levels in decades. And we actually started having food riots around the world. There were food riots in Haiti, there were food riots in the Middle East, because people were just unable to afford these new food prices.
It wasn't just because of oil, though, also, right? It was combining that with drought, which a lot of people are connecting with climate change.
Exactly. So when we look at the first big increase in oil prices in 2007, 2008, drought was not as much of an issue, but things had actually changed a couple years later. So the recession happened, it caused a brief respite, but by the time that 2010 came around, oil prices, energy prices were again high. That was pressuring food prices, but then we actually started seeing something happening globally. And so there was a combination of droughts that year. Now, whether any individual drought is attributable to climate change is obviously a complex question that depends on climate science. But we saw that that year there were droughts in a lot of the major grain-producing areas around the world. There were droughts in Australia, Russia, China, the United States, Brazil. And so in addition to having oil and energy prices pushing up the price of food, you also had severe supply constraints happening. And so one of the things that why it became really important is that these food prices were very, very high, and they had a disproportionate impact across the Middle East. And so in early 2011, we had what became known as the Arab Spring. And that is when countries all across Middle East and North Africa rose up in popular protest against the running of their countries. Now, I don't want to overstate this point, but it is really important to emphasize that food played a major role in those uprisings. And the situation, and this is something that we really do need to understand when we're talking about climate change and talking about the potential impacts in society, it's not that climate change causes any specific thing, it's rather it's impacting existing conditions. And in the Middle East, we had some very specific conditions that create a situation that could be very chaotic. And so the big problems are that you had governments that were not responsive to their people. They were not democracies. A lot of them had been doing bad management for years. A lot of them had to deal with very significant population growth. And the combination of not having a responsive government, inadequate economic growth, and a growing population meant that youth unemployment in some of these countries was reaching 30, 40, 50%. So when you have these situations that are already causing significant social tension, having food prices all of a sudden go up, really kind of push the situation over.
And we have an extremely chaotic situation in Syria, which also suffered some terrible drought leading up to what we are seeing right now in Syria in terms of its civil war. From 2007 to 2010, you write, Syria suffered its worst drought in record, with climate change identified as a likely factor.
Yeah, so Syria in a lot of ways kind of had a 1-2 double punch. So before all these, before the high food prices and the general chaos caused the Arab Spring, we actually had the situation primed for much more chaos in Syria. And so, as you said, between 2007 and 2010, they had a very, very major drought. Unlike the other droughts mentioned earlier, which you'd have to look at individually, there has definitively been a climate signal identified there. It was their worst drought in at least 100 years, potentially longer. And in Syria, one of the effects of this drought was to cause a rapid increase in rural to urban migration. You had about 1.5 million people move from rural areas to cities because they were unable to survive on subsistence agriculture anymore. And the government, and again, this is important to emphasize, it wasn't just this drought and climate change that caused these issues. The government there was unable to provide adequate services and adequate resource management. So when these situations happened, the government was not in a good place to, so to say, adapt to the new situation. And so in a country like Syria, where it's still a developing country, its pre-war population was around 24 million. The movement of 1.5 million people in a forced internal migration in a matter of 3 or 4 years is very, very chaotic. Add in the fact that you had already simmering tensions that Syria is not a natural state. It is a multi-ethnic state that was drawn after decolonization. Add in the fact that you also have Iraqi refugees from the Iraqi or the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You end up in a situation where in Syria, the protesters in the streets were just met by gunfire and bullets. They were met by a very, very heavy-handed response by the Assad regime
In 2011,
in
right?
2011. And over the course of 2011, because you had certain circumstances in Syria that were different than these other countries, especially the multi-ethnic aspect, that really led to a situation which led to war.
Generals gathered in the masses, just like witches at black masses, evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death construction. In the fields, the bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Hatred to mankind,
follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Alex Gilbert. He's an energy consultant and the co-founder of Spark Library. So we just were talking about the beginnings of the Syrian civil war. Why don't you explain how this has devolved, if you will?
So over the course of a couple of years, the situation really, really got a lot worse. Now, Assad had to make certain strategic decisions at the time, which one of the most important was, one was pulling his forces out of the Kurdish regions in Syria. But one of the other ones that he made, and this is really important, is he realized that he would not be able to defeat all the forces arrayed against him on his own. And so in Syria, there's not one side. It's not Assad versus the opposition or the rebels. The rebels have always been a bunch of different groups that are former army officers, that are students, that are Islamists, jihadis. and you ended up in a situation where you have a mix of moderate and extremist rebels. And one of the things that had originally led the Obama administration to be uncertain about supplying weapons to the rebels is they didn't know whose hands the weapons would end up to. There's concerns that it would end up in the hands of extremists that could then be used against us. So Assad developed a strategy where he went ahead and targeted the moderate rebels. He realized that the extremist rebels would never be acceptable to Western powers. And so as long as the moderate rebels were there, we could either get involved directly or we could support the war against them. So he started targeting them. And the big thing is that the precursor to ISIS, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had established operations in Syria, which quickly led to what later became ISIS. And Assad very intentionally did not target ISIS in a lot of ways. They had kind of a complicit agreement in certain parts of the country that they wouldn't attack each other, so that ISIS could focus on a lot of Assad's enemies, Assad could focus on his own enemies, and then ISIS exploded onto the scene. ISIS really forced the United States to get involved when they crossed the Iraq border in mid-2014. The big thing is that they started a genocide against the Yazidi people, which is a small minority in the area. Absolutely atrocious stuff. But then they also started making moves against the Iraqi government. So Iraq, even though even years after our invasion, still had very serious political issues stemming from the Sunni-Shia divide. And so they went ahead and just took advantage of that. And the U.S. soon began our campaign against ISIS. And soon ISIS became the chief international terrorist organization that we were really worried about. While all of this was happening in Iraq, ISIS was also making significant advances against the Kurdish regions in Syria. At the beginning of the war, like I said, Assad had moved his forces out of the Kurdish regions, and so he just removed all of his security forces there, and the people there developed their own security forces. So this is really important to understand about the Kurdish people. The Kurds are a nation without a state. There are large Kurdish populations in Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. And one of their goals for many, many, many years has been to develop their own country, to link all of the Kurds together. And so what this has meant for Turkey is that they've actually had a decades-long insurgency in their Kurdish region from Kurdish terrorist groups. The millions and millions of refugees, we end up having, I think, 3 million refugees in Turkey now that from Syria that have fled over from their general war, combined with the renewed insurgency, put Turkey into a very significant insecure state. And that is kind of the underlying of the recent rise of authoritarian power under President Erdogan there. And he was able to really capitalize upon what was happening with this instability upon the entire region to start pushing back against a lot of pro-Kurdish efforts in the area.
So we've talked about Turkey and the U.S. We haven't really spoken about the Russian role in all this. How does somebody like Paul Manafort inject himself into this story, Alex?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So in addition to the earlier issues that the United States had with Russia and Ukraine, in 2015, when the Syrian regime was really struggling, Russia intervened in the Syrian war and started airstrikes to support the Syrian regime. That continued through 2016, but that really aggravated a lot of the tensions between the United States and Russia. And it's increasingly apparent that at this point, Vladimir Putin decided that the U.S. Was posing a very significant threat to his interests in Ukraine and in Syria. And it seems likely that the Russians decided to get involved in the 2016 campaign. What is unclear is when and how, and that's one of the areas that we're actually starting to get a lot more answers with. So first off, one of the main characters and key players in the Trump campaign for a long time is Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort had actually spent a decade in Ukraine working for a pro-Putin party, and that Putin party, the president of that party, ended up causing a lot of the issues there, got thrown out of power, really was kind of the source of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And so after that, there's a couple years where he was not necessarily on the radar, but he ended up heading the Trump campaign for most of the middle of 2016. And in August 2016, he was actually forced out of the campaign when it emerged that he'd been taking potentially a lot of bribes from the Ukrainian leader during his time in the Ukraine. And the Ukrainian government now has been looking at him as a major suspect, and he's basically wanted by them. And so when he was forced out, a lot of questions started arising around him. But one of the other people that stayed in and really, I think, is going to be kind of the root of a lot of the political scandal we talk about is Michael Flynn. So Flynn is a retired general from the U.S. He was forced out during the Obama administration because he was not really doing a good job. He was treating classified information in a very unsafe manner. And he was an early supporter of Trump. And for whatever reason, the Trump administration has really liked him, but he has some very fishy ties. In 2015, after obviously Putin had decided to get involved in the election, but before it became obvious that he was going to be supporting the Trump campaign, he ended up getting invited to Russia. He went to a big gala for the Russian television station where he actually sat right next to Vladimir Putin. He received a significant amount of payment for that, for a speech he gave there, in addition to some other small speeches from Russian-related entities. And it appears that he did not properly report that in, any of those payments, nor receive permission for them, which he has to do as a foreign officer. He has to receive permission from the U.S. Congress for foreign emoluments. So he did that. He ended up becoming very closely involved with the Trump campaign. At one point, they wanted him to be the vice president. And then around August 2016, he began a contract for his company. It was funded by a Turkish man who had ties to Vladimir Putin through an energy executive. And that contract was about $500,000. And what happened is that between mid-summer of 2016, when Flynn had been, seen to be very much against the Turkish push towards authoritarianism under Erdogan, on election day, he actually published a op-ed that was very supportive of the president, President Erdogan, and his rising authoritarianism. And so that is a really big flag that he received this massive payment, changed a very big opinion about just foreign policy. And then within a matter of weeks, he was selected as national security advisor. In December, he had a call with the Russian ambassador, which a lot of people have known about, where he was talking actually about the sanctions on Russia from the Ukraine invasion, as well as more recent sanctions the Obama administration just put on. And then importantly, in January of 2017, it appears that Flynn played a key role in delaying a U.S.-supported assault on ISIS's capital. And that assault would be led by the Kurds that we support in the region that Turkey does not want us supporting. There's really no other alternative for us to take that capital, take the capital of ISIS, Raqqa, without actually involving tens of thousands of U.S. ground troops. And so there's this really big question there. Did Flynn's decision delay the finishing off of ISIS as a landed terrorist entity? That Raqqa is their last big, really, bastion of power. And if his decision did do that, is it because he was paid by Turkey? That is really what a lot of the initial scandal was that is now kind of really enveloping Washington, is now how the Trump administration has treated the facts and the details around that.
Yeah, and when you saw John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, talking about, without using Flynn's name explicitly, he's talking about how one who goes down a treasonous path often doesn't realize they're on that path until it's too late. I think he was talking about Flynn and the Raqqa attack more than the discussion about sanctions, because this was after he's in office and there was a, and he was perhaps going against America's best interest because of his financial connection to a foreign power.
Yes, and that is something that is really concerning for a lot of the national security complex in the United States. And it's really, I think, that revelation coming out, as it did in the last week or so, really shows why there are so many leaks going on and why there's so much concern about the Trump administration's foreign ties. Because this is not just a matter of foreign ties to Russia anymore. It's a matter of foreign ties to Russia and Turkey in a way that's very questionably jeopardizing our national security. Now, obviously, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts there, but that's a really big concern that I don't really think we had even 2 or 3 weeks ago, at least publicly.
Yeah. done nothing but build and destroy.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy consultant Alex Gilbert.
This is obviously going to just be unfolding on a day-to-day basis, and it's hard to kind of predict where we're going. But to put a bow on this discussion, I could talk to you for another hour about it, but would this have happened if there had not been droughts that led to food shortages in the region? Would this have happened if the U.S. had not gone full throttle into the shale gas revolution, in your estimation?
I think that that's a fantastic question. It's a really hard counterfactual to say, but it's something that I think we should actually really be asking is, to what degree do these type of events occur? I mean, if we're really talking impacts of climate change on Syria all the way to Flynn helping Turkey in the United States, it's a pretty big butterfly effect. But we need to understand that when it comes to geopolitics, when it comes to international relations, relatively small changes can have massive, massive impacts that are really hard to see. And that's if we talk about Syria and in Syria, climate change is an important factor. It's not the deciding factor. It's not why there's a war there. There's a war there because Assad refuses to leave and because there's significant ethnic tensions in the country. But what this does really show us looking forward is that climate change is problematic, not because of any direct impacts of climate change, but for how it can have really significant knock-on social impacts. That, but for the fact that there was so much instability in Syria due to climate change, we might not have had as serious of an issue there war-wise. The war could have either been shorter or could not have been as severe, and that could have definitely changed our current foreign relations issues with Turkey. It's really hard to say, and the way that I would put it is that as a precautionary principle, we have enough to deal with in the next century with different rising powers around the world changing geopolitics. No matter what, climate change will make almost all of that worse because it will aggravate tensions, it will aggravate resource issues. Now, the energy side of things with oil prices, that's a bit different. But what I will say is that really the impacts of low oil prices go way beyond economic issues with Russia. They're really impacting world politics in a way that's very, very profound. Venezuela is on the verge of collapse because they just were way too dependent on oil revenues. At this point, they're having clashes in the street every week where people are getting killed. Saudi Arabia seems to be making long-term decisions, assuming low oil prices. It's something that these are not necessarily things that are predictive, but they're something that we really need to understand, that they are real, that they're severe, and that the U.S. energy, because of energy and climate, really can't isolate itself from the rest of the world anymore. More than anything, we really need to engage with a foreign policy that recognizes our role in energy geopolitics, but also play a role that recognizes climate change can really upset the current international order, which favors us, and act accordingly.
He's the co-founder of energy and consulting firm Spark Library, Alex Gilbert. Alex, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Allman Brothers Band, Ruthie Foster, and the North Mississippi All-Stars.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.